Welcome to Going Beyond Medicine with Elaine Grohman. Conversations with people who are working to make a difference in our world. Now here's your host for Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio, Elaine Grohman.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Elaine Grohman on Empower Radio, and the show is Going Beyond Medicine. And today I'm going to take a little bit of a different twist on the show. Last week, I had the wonderful opportunity to interview a woman by the name of Nancy Cristiano, who works for a company called Population Media Center, which works to help people become more aware of the problem of women's and girls' rights in regard particularly to reproduction, the sustainability and the challenges that we are creating with stripping the planet of its resources, and of course, how we need to really be mindful of our environment. And shortly, a few days later, I was given the gift of this amazing hardcover coffee table book, which is eye-opening and disturbing and enlightening. And it is called Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. And on the cover of the book is a beautiful photo of our planet, our amazing home. And this book is published by Population Media Center and the Population Institute. And this book brings home the challenge that we have created as human beings and the challenges that we are creating in our own lives of our own volition because of our greedy need for overdevelopment, overpopulation, and overshoot. And so today what I want to do is to really share the information in this book and highly, highly recommend to you that you consider getting a copy of this book. Learn more about what we're doing to the planet and the things that we really need to be mindful of. And the book starts out with a foreword. And the foreword is written by a woman by the name of Mushimbi Kanyoro. And she is a native of Kenya, is the president and CEO of the Global Fund for Women. And she is a leading champion for human rights, the health of women and girls, and social change-centered philanthropy. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. Kanyoro has international experience in the field of sexual and reproductive health and rights, and that spans more than three decades. Prior to her current position, she was the director of the Population and Reproduction Health Program of the David and Lucille Packard Foundation. The introduction is by a gentleman named William Ryerson, who is the founder and president of Population Media Center and also serves as CEO of the Population Institute in Washington, D.C. He has a 40-year history of working in the field of reproductive health, including two decades of experience adapting the Sabino methodology of social change communication to various cultural settings worldwide. So what I'm going to do is just kind of talk to you about this book. And the book starts out with a beautiful parable. And this parable is entitled Lord Man. And I actually am going to change that word from beautiful to thought-provoking. I'm going to read this from the book. In the beginning, the world was whole and beauty prevailed. Life begetting life until the waters and the lands were filled with creatures. Myriads were their languages, from the nearly imperceptible song of moss to the bugling of elk. Whales performed their symphonies in the deep. The sounds of life were everywhere. Life pulsed and contracted and flourished through the ages. Eventually, a being appeared who learned to speak and count. For millennia, he lived well among his wild kin. But as his cleverness grew, so did his ambitions, until the day he declared himself ruler of all. Believing the self-deception that his kind was sovereign over the others, he taught his children that the earth had been made for man's use and profit. he no longer recognized his neighbors in the community of life, instead calling them quote-unquote natural resources. His work he named progress. The old religions, which had long tied the human tribe to the other creatures in a circle of reciprocity, were forgotten. Feigning himself Lord Man, he grew ever more clever. He learned to gather and to burn fuel, fossil fuel, made by ancient geological forces. Praise was sung incessantly to the new god. Growth. His numbers became multitudes. As the multitudes spread across the face of the earth, the songs of the other creatures grew fewer and fainter. Many voices went permanently quiet, replaced by the sound of machines, digging, churning, scarring the land, and driving the whales crazy with their noise. Every day, the earth grew poorer, transformed bit by bit by Lord Man's numbers and actions. The seas were emptied of fish and filled with garbage. The trees were replaced by bleeding stumps. The prairies were transformed into feeding factories for the ever-expanding human masses. Smokestacks darkened the skies. No place was sacred. No landscape safe from the insatiable creature's thirst for more energy to serve his god of growth. Lord Man tamed rivers, split atoms, decapitated mountains, and stabbed the earth everywhere he thought a vein of fuel lay hidden. When the feverish earth cried out, sending furies to communicate her distress, Lord Man ignored the growing sickness until it could no longer be denied. Slowly, the scales began to fall from his eyes when he saw famine ravage the land. When he saw precious sources of fresh water disappear. When the longing that gnawed on his spirit made him recall so many creatures that had passed into oblivion. Seeing the effects of his hubris, he began to wonder if his empire was secure. His delusion weakened just enough to reveal the choice before him. Two paths, one leading to an abundant earth filled with birdsong, the other, the way of growth, offering riches for some, misery for many, and ultimate destruction for all his tribe. Would he restrain his numbers and rejoin the community of life as plain member and citizen? Or attempt to engineer all the earth to his will, heeding only the call for more? That is the parable of Lord Man. And this book, which is hard to view, but full of truths, of literally hundreds of pages of photos of what we as humans have done to this beautiful planet. And one of the things that William Ryerson speaks about, and which is so important for us to begin to understand, is the challenge that we have created has become cultural beliefs. And cultural beliefs that have steered us into very dark places. And as William Ryerson has spent so much of his life looking at the problem of overpopulation. He has so beautifully and succinctly brought together these very challenging photographs for us to look at the reality of what we have created. And what he talks about is in the beginning of this book, and something that we cannot really dismiss, is the population of the planet. And I'm going to read from this book. Those who blithely dismiss the challenges posed by population growth like to say that we could physically squeeze 7 billion people into an area the size of Texas. They don't stop to consider the suffering already caused by overpopulation. The population debate is not about the maximum number of people that could be packed onto the planet. The crucial question is, how many people can the Earth sustain at a reasonable standard of living while leaving room for the diversity of life to flourish? There is no precise answer to this question, but the facts overwhelmingly support one conclusion. We cannot go on the way we are going. We are already doing severe and irreparable harm to the planet. Something has to give. As I continue to read these statistics, I think it's important to share this information from the introduction by William Ryerson of the book Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot, as I continue to share this. If we cannot live sustainably with 7.2 billion people, how are we going to support billions more by the end of this century? The United Nations' latest medium variant project indicates that we could have 10.9 billion people by 2100. But that may be an underestimation. Fertility rates in many parts of the world are not falling as fast as previously anticipated. In some countries, both developed and developing, fertility rates are actually on the rise again. In 2014, the global total fertility rate, meaning the average number of children born to each woman during her lifetime, was 2.5. If this rate were to remain unchanged, demographers suggest that we could have 27 billion on the planet by the end of the century. Given our limited inheritance of soil, water, and arable land, sustaining a global population of that size is not even remotely possible. That's a quote from this book. So one of the things that this book very clearly looks at the beginning of this book, is overpopulation. And we as Americans have a tendency to think, oh, we only have on average 2.5 kids per family. Well, that would be great if that were true. And it's not just the United States that we need to think about in relation to how this earth must sustain. And not only sustain in terms of food, because that is part of what people think about. They think about food and they think about space. But we often forget to take into account what is the physical ramifications of a female human being giving birth to multiple children, in particular at such tender ages of early adolescence, and be expected to have any kind of quality of life and have the wherewithal, the maturity, the resources, the time and the energy to actually help to raise a healthy human being. Again, I'm going to read from the demographic explosion portion of this book, Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. And I'm reading from the book. With the present human population that has surged past 7 billion and is growing fast, Most people assume that rapid population growth is normal. It's not. During almost all of human history, our numbers have been either stable or growing imperceptibly, less than 1/500th of 1%, according to a leading demographer. Population growth ticked up significantly after the invention of agriculture, but the rate of increase was still only a small fraction of 1%. Then, around the start of the Industrial Revolution, some two centuries ago, a convergence of factors set the stage for a demographic explosion. Most notably, humans being able to exploit the vast fossil energy storehouse laid down by ancient geological forces: coal, oil, and natural gas. The modern era's exploitation of this energy windfall has coincided with the suite of rapid advances in agricultural productivity, science, and medicine that has lowered death rates and increased lifespans, leading to ballooning human populations around the globe. So, what does that mean? Most people will say, well, you can't take away my reproductive rights. That's not what is being said here. What is being said is, we need to be mindful of the fact that well over a couple of centuries ago, only a couple of centuries ago, before the Industrial Revolution, people were very mindful of what they were doing, or much more mindful of what they were doing, and became aware of their need for being able to provide what their family needed within a geological area. And certainly, historically, we have had the challenge of many cultures still involved in what's called child marriage. And in fact, I'm going to quote Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Grace Machel, who said, "Child marriage happens because adults believe that they have the right to impose marriage upon a child. This denies children, particularly girls, their dignity and the opportunity to make choices that are central to their lives, such as when and whom to marry and when to have children. Choices define us and allow us to realize our potential. Child marriage robs girls of this chance." And in this book, there are literally full pages of photographs that demonstrate not only the volume of people, the volume, but the mass ways in which we degrade one another. We really need to begin to look at, what are we thinking? What are we doing? We see and we talk about the challenges of crime. We talk about the challenges of human depression and anxiety. We talk about the challenges of suicide and the prevalence of suicide. But we fail to look at, most importantly, what are causing all of these stressors? Is it that we have so many children and we have so much overpopulation and we have so much overdevelopment and the belief that we must sustain all of this on infinitum, as if there was a limitless amount of resources on this planet? And we fail to take into account, what is the human toll? What is the human toll of both parents having to work ungodly hours, 40 plus hours a week? Where are the children? Who is caring for the children? How can children that are not raised and guided in anything other than lots of other people, how are they given the individual time that they need? Now, please understand that I experienced some of these things myself. I understand what challenges it creates. But we are very culturally brought to a belief that we must do things in particular ways, that we must work 40 plus hours a week, that we must have every new thing that exists, that we must, that we must, that we must. And we forget to look at what does that actually mean to all of us. William Ralph Ing wrote, "The command to be fruitful and multiply was promulgated, according to our authorities, when the population of the world consisted of two people." And many religions have taken that to the nth degree and have asked that people do not recognize their need to be mindful of how many people they are able to bring into the world, or how many people they do bring into the world, but are unable to care for them the way that they need to be cared for. In this book, it talks about the fact that there is a human tide. And again, I'm going to read from this book. "It is through the sheer mass of society, not simply from malevolence, that the rising human tide has become deadly to the rest of life. The collective weight of a bloated humanity has dire ecological and social consequences. Every pressure problems from poverty and malnutrition to biodiversity loss and climate change is linked to human numbers and behaviors. In aggregate, the prosaic action of people, eating, manufacturing, polluting, shopping, warring, have made our species the functional equivalent of a geological force, able to affect even the global life support systems and climate in which our species evolved." When we look at the books, this book, and the sheer number of the mass of people, we have to really look at what are we doing? What do we think we're going to accomplish with this much and without ways of sustaining it? The question, George Woodwill says, "The question of how many people the world can support is unanswerable in a finite sense. What do we want? Are there global limits, absolute limits beyond critical, beyond which we cannot go without catastrophic or overwhelming costs? There are, most certainly. We have an opportunity to begin to look at what are we doing, what is our personal footprint on this planet? What is our personal responsibility? What is our ability to respond? What is our choice doing to everything? Humans evolved in wild nature. Only relatively recently in our time on Earth, roughly 10 to 12 millennium ago, did we begin to domesticate other species and ourselves. This first agricultural revolution set humanity on a trajectory of population growth and settlement-based land use. Increased social organization and the invention of cities went hand in hand to allow development of increasingly complex economic and political systems. In 2008, for the first time in history, that a majority of humans on Earth lived in cities. We have become, at least superficially, urban animals." I'm going to take a break in just a minute, and we're going to continue with looking at this incredible book, and I would highly recommend that you go to Population Media Center, populationmedia.org, look at the book, look at the work that we can do as humans to begin to change what we're doing on the planet so that we can begin to undo some of the challenges that we have created. And in a relatively short period of time, we have created this. Please stay with us. I'll continue talking about this wonderful book, Over Development, Over Population, Overshoot, when I come back. This is Elaine Grillman for Going Beyond Medicine and Empower Radio. Please stay with me.
You're listening to Empower Radio, an entire radio station devoted to your personal development, expanding your conscious awareness, and empowering positive change. Meet our hosts and listen online at empowerradio.com, on iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher Radio, or iTunes, or download the Empower Radio app for your smartphone or tablet. It's free in the App Store, and it lets you listen to our shows and podcasts on demand. Empowering people, empowering change. Empower Radio, online at empowerradio.com.
Hi, I'm Linda Ellerbe. Did you know that every 3 minutes, another woman gets the news she has breast cancer? I got it 11 years ago, and I know how scary it can be. Everything your doctor says sounds like a foreign language. HER2-NU, oncogene, aromatase inhibitor, ductal carcinoma in situ. What do these words mean? How are you going to decide what to do if you can't even say what you have? Please listen. As soon as you get your diagnosis, go to breastcancer.org. It's a special place on the internet where you can learn how to say all those breast cancer words and find out what they mean. At breastcancer.org, you can learn more about your particular kind of cancer and your treatment options, and get all kinds of other useful information to guide you and your family through this. The first place to go the minute you find you have breast cancer, breastcancer.org.
You're struggling with your mortgage. You think about it. You don't do anything but think about it.
What are we going to do if we lose the house? Where are we going to go?
At work.
I can't let anybody find out. I'm so embarrassed.
At dinner.
How can I tell the kids? It's going to wreck their lives.
And at 3 o'clock in the morning.
I don't know what to do. I don't know how to get through this. What's going to happen to us?
It's time to stop thinking. It's time to start dialing. Call 1-888-995-HOPE for a free government program that offers expert one-on-one advice about your mortgage options.
I'm all alone.
No, you're not. We've helped over a million homeowners, and we want to help you. And now there are more ways to help. Call 1-888-995-HOPE or visit makinghomeaffordable.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Wildfires burn millions of acres across the country each year. And each year, wildland firefighters battle to contain them, but they can't do it alone. For some communities, it's not a question of if wildfires strike, but when. And a single ember can travel more than 1 mile. As it twists and turns and floats through the air, that single ember can find its way to where you live and can ignite and destroy your home or your community. That single ember can be just as dangerous as the wildfire itself. You can't control where the ember will land, but you can control what happens when it does. You can take action now to prepare your home and your community for wildfire. Get fire adapted. Learn what you can do now to reduce wildfire damage later at fireadapted.org. Prepare, protect, prevail. A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council. Learn more at fireadapted.org.
Now back to Elaine Groman and Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio.
EmpowerRadio.com.
Good afternoon. This is Elaine Groman. And today, instead of interviewing anyone or just talking about a particular subject, I am talking about a book that came to my attention and was gifted to me by Nancy Cristiano and Rick Kraniak. And this book was published by Population Media Center and Population Institute, and it's called Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. And it is a huge coffee table book that really brings home to us what we need to pay attention to in what we are doing by overpopulating the world, the earth, overconsuming, and overindustrializing to our own peril. So really what I'm doing is really reading from the book so that we can read this information and not dismiss it, because we cannot afford to. In this particular part of the book called Material World, I'm going to read this description. The sheer volume of raw materials that must be mined, refined, processed, transported, and manufactured into products to serve billions of people and eventually be disposed almost defies imagination. It is not, however, incalculable. Efforts to gather such data have become increasingly sophisticated, And when combined with various assessments as part of a ecological footprint analysis, can offer a broadly representative picture of humanity's global impact. This picture isn't pretty. From cradle to grave, as raw materials are transformed into products, this process of material throughput causes ecological damage. Behind that damage to the earth is the idea of perpetual economic growth being synonymous with progress. In the overdeveloped world, a ubiquitous advertising industry fuels an ethic of hyperconsumption. In the developing world, the grave problem of poverty and social inequality are frequently met with programs to strengthen traditional community structures, but with ill-conceived efforts to modernize and turn citizens into participants of an ever-expanding global consumer society. So what we need to take into account, my fellow citizens of this earth, is what we're doing to the natural world and to other living species. And because of our drive to have more, do more, be more, to control more, we are unraveling nature. And in this section of the book, Nature's Unraveling, I will read, five deep contractions in life's diversity are recorded in the fossil record, the last occurring 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs were extinct. Those previous mass extinction events were all precipitated by natural causes. The sixth and current great extinction is caused by humanity's destruction of intact habitat, overkilling of wildlife, and climate disruption. Nature's death is by a thousand cuts, from deforestation, livestock overgrazing, conversion of wild habitats to agriculture, industrial development, mining, pollution, spread of invasive species, energy contraction, extraction in myriad forms, etc. The cuts come from many blades, but the result is the same. Biological impoverishment, as ecosystems are degraded and native species are lost. Moreover, each of these nicks on nature represents the loss of wild beauty. Because humanity depends on healthy ecosystems for clean air and water, fertile soil, and pollination services, the unraveling of nature should alarm every human being on Earth. Again, as I look through this book, the photos are just gut-wrenching. When we look at what has happened when we have deforested huge, huge acreages of land, and how this has then also led to, well, when we run out of wood, what are we going to do when we run out of oil, or when we run out of natural gas, or when we run out of coal? And the aerial views from space of how we have created pockmarks all across the globe, scarring her and creating untold destruction that will take centuries to rebuild if we don't stop what we're doing. In one picture that shows the Atlantic Ocean, it's quoted by Carl Safina, "If you're overfishing at the top of the food chain and acidifying the ocean at the bottom, you're creating a squeeze that could conceivably collapse the whole system." And we can't even begin to fathom what would happen if we could not get a drop of water out of our faucets. If we couldn't stand at an ocean or a lake and see beauty. And if we forget, when we can't afford to forget, that our bodies are mostly water. If we don't have that resource, we will die. The next section is wildlife loss. And again, I will read. For humanity's burgeoning numbers and selfish behavior to be the cause of other species slide into extinction is the clearest marker that our present course is both unsustainable and unethical. Even while 95% of scientifically described species have yet to be analyzed for their conservation status, the IUCN, which stands for the International Union for Conservation of Nature, which tracks the status of imperiled species around the globe, lists some 20,000 species. 20,000 species that are threatened with extinction. Given the relative paucity of data about various groups of organisms, the actual numbers of species on the cusp of oblivion is certainly far larger. And numerous scientific studies have noted that the accelerating trend of biodiversity loss. Humanity's assault on wildlife isn't new. But 7+ billion people armed with advanced technology, from bottom scoring trawlers that mine the sea of fish to endocrine disrupting chemicals that affect wild species' reproductive success, to violent poachers decimating elephants for their ivory tusks, are simply more lethal to wildlife now than at any point in human history. In this section of the book, Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot, there are photos that are just absolutely gut-wrenching of mountains of ivory that has already been used, or tusks of gigantic fish caught in nets that had no chance of survival in the Pacific Ocean. There is a photo that was taken in Hong Kong of a man walking over literally thousands upon thousands of fins. And on this page, from quoting from E.O. Wilson, except for giant meteoric strikes or other such catastrophes, Earth has never experienced anything like the contemporary human juggernaut. We are in a bottleneck of overpopulation and wasteful consumption that could push half of Earth's species to extinction in this century. And because of what we're doing so vehemently and ruthlessly damaging the environment, we're causing problems to other species like oil spills and spills of pollution. And the very famous scientist Diane Fossey in this photo is they're carrying in Uganda the beautiful dead body of a great ape. The mountain gorilla faces grave danger of extinction, primarily because the encroachment of native man upon its habitat, a neglect by civilized man, who does not conscientiously protect even the limited areas now allotted for the gorilla's survival. We give them a postage stamp size of land on which to live, these great beings, and we expect them not to respond. And yet even we don't give that land the sanctity it deserves. And in the Antarctic Ocean, there is a massive photo of a great whale being hauled up onto a ship that you wonder why. And I'm not even sure which species this is, whether this is bears. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of feet, literally their feet of bears, just laying there as trophies. It's unimaginable what we're doing. And in the Midwest, in the Midway Islands, there is a photo of a bird that has died and decayed on land. And you don't see any organs inside of it. All you see is plastic. Because these beautiful species that get all of their nutrients from the waters are gulping in volumes and volumes and volumes of our waste. So on this particular page with this beautiful body of this bird in total decay with all of these multicolored plastic objects within its decayed body is a quote from Ecclesiastes. And it says, "Surely the fate of human beings is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so does the other. All have the same breath." And in Denmark, the slaughter of whales. And in the USA, United States, what our pesticides are doing to the honeybees. And those beautiful, silent little creatures that pollinate the food that we eat. And then, of course, there's the energy blight. And this is another section in this book. And I'll read this. "Modern techno-industrial society runs on energy. Massive amounts of inexpensive, continuously available power generated primarily from fossil fuels. Around 1800, at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, the global human population was roughly 1 billion. It has taken our entire lifetime as a species to reach that milestone. In the subsequent two centuries, the human population has grown more than sevenfold, and energy use per capita has increased by more than 30 times. Clearly, as a species, we have gotten tremendously clever at deploying energy resources to support population and economic growth. But at what cost? The energy sector likely affects a greater area than any other actively except agriculture. It seems there is nothing we won't do. No landscape too precious to exploit for energy production. Even as landscapes across the globe are blithed in the mad rush for more energy to fuel growth, billions of people on Earth still have little or no access to energy resources that can improve their health and prospects for the future." We are so, so, so out of balance. And in the next section about foul water, there is an image of a man from China who is so ravaged by being exposed to polluted waters. And I will read from this section. "Water is life. Without it, we perish. Clean water and healthy seas are fundamental to the future welfare of humanity. And yet, the industrial growth economy wastes copious amounts of water and treats the living oceans as a dumping ground for our affluent. This disdain may stem, at least in part, from an old myth. The idea that the seas were limitless and their abundance immune to the efforts of people. There may have been true when we were few and our tools were simple. It is not true today, when we are overabundant and no part of the ocean is out of reach of industrial fisheries. The aggregate demands of a bloated humanity on marine and freshwater systems leave less and less room for nature and put billions of people at risk of having inadequate drinking water." I was having this discussion the other day with several people of how it was that even in my childhood, we just drank our water out of glasses from the faucet. Or if we had an opportunity, we would pump it from a hand pump, which was always kind of a interesting thing when something came from an artesian well. And now we think it's fashionable to drink it out of plastic bottles. My daughter, Lainey Rubio, who is a homeschooling mom in Louisiana, works really hard to teach kids about the earth. And she was telling me that the other day that with the kids that are in this homeschooling group, they did a little experiment and they bought every kind of bottled water that they could and they tested it for its acidity with litmus paper. And then took regular tap water from their area and tested it. They found that every single bottled water, which we get in our grocery stores or our convenience stores or our gas stations, every single one of them had an acidity count that was extremely high. Not good for any human body. We know that an acidic body is likely to become a cancerous body. And she found that their tap water was actually pH neutral, which is what our body needs. And we glorify this notion that we have to have these quote-unquote conveniences. Well, I don't know what's inconvenient about holding a glass of water in your hand. Nothing is inconvenient about that. So on this one page of a gentleman sitting cross-legged in what appears to be or have been at one time a stream in India, which is absolutely littered with trash, plastic, all kinds of things. And he's sitting there trying to bathe. And the quote from Sir Peter Blake on that page is, "Good water, good health. Poor water, poor health. No water, no life." And so this book is a hard one to look at, but one that we must look at. And there is no continent on the globe that is not affected by this incredible waste. And another photo shows a man in water that looks like it's actually just all foam. And it is so obviously polluted that it's amazing that this human being is standing in it. And in China, another one, you think that you're looking at a field of grass, but it is actually an algae, overpopulation of algae that's growing on the waters of this place in China. And it says, although biologists are at a loss to explain the most recent algae bloom, scientists suspect that its connection to pollution and increased seaweed farming. While similar green tides have been reported around the world, the annual bloom in the Yellow Sea is considered the largest, growing to an estimated million tons of biomass each year, that it looks like you're actually looking at grass, but you're looking at moss that is growing in the water. So we also need to look at what we're doing to our skies. And this section is called The Darkening Skies. The air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions that are dumped into the global atmosphere at no cost to the polluters are, in the lexicon of economists, externalities. The reality, of course, is that we all pay, in the end, through shortened lives, increased healthcare expenses, and the quickly rising ecological and social costs of a disrupted climate. A universal human experience is to look skyward at the heavens and to feel free and to feel a sense of wonder. Within the very atmospheric chemistry of the planet, altered by our polluting, fossil fuel-based energy economy, will future generations look skyward with hope or with fear? And I'd like to end the show with a parable redux of Lord Man, so that we do know that they There is possibilities for us to change, but we must begin, every one of us. And this is the Parable Redux. Facing the stark choice to continue his futile quest to bend the earth to his will, or to rejoin the community of life, Lord Man renounced the goal of empire and was no more. People around the globe began to remember the old ways before humans behaved as if the earth was merely a storehouse of resources for them. The people looked to the landscapes around them to inform their culture and shape their ways of living. They valued the other members in the land community, giving them space enough to flourish in their own ways. Knowledge and tools for family planning were universally shared. People began to restrain their numbers, with smaller families becoming a key to societal well-being. Children were allowed to be children, not forced into marriage with adults. All the children were loved, and all were encouraged to follow their dreams. Development priorities began to shift from more to better. Economic objectives shifted towards sustainability, sufficiency, and resilience. Actions were judged ethical or not by whether they helped sustain beauty, biodiversity, and health. The people chose lives of quality with sufficient time for the activities and relationships that gave them joy. Eventually, the people forgot the dark days when they sought to rule, and they honored their new relationship with Earth. Whales, unmolested, sang in the deep. The sounds of leaves rustled, and children laughed. Children laughing settled over the land, and the tree of life grew towards the sky. So the afterwards is written by a woman named Eileen Christ, Choosing a Planet of Life. And what I hope to have been able to share with you in this hour is a new way of thinking about our one and only home, our one and only planet that for many, many years, thousands and thousands of years, it's hard to believe that in 1800, our planet had 1 billion people. In 1930, we had 2 billion. By 1987, we had 5 billion. By 1999, we had 6 billion. By 2011, we had 7 billion. And if we keep going, by 2025, we will have 8 billion people on this planet. So this book was sponsored and published by Population Media Center, which is populationmedia.org, is a nonprofit international non-governmental organization which strives to improve the health and well-being of people around the world through the use of entertainment education strategies, such as serialized dramas on radio and television, in which characters evolve into role models for the audience. Founded in 1998, PMC has successfully used behavior change communication in more than 50 countries. And the Population Institute, populationinstitute.org, provides essential leadership to promote voluntary family planning and reproductive health services and increase awareness of the social, economic, and environmental consequences of rapid population growth. Founded in 1969 and based in Washington, D.C., the Population Institute works to educate policymakers, the media, and the general public about population issues. The Institute promotes both international and U.S. support for voluntary family planning programs and supports full legal, political, economic, and social equality for women, including sexual and reproductive rights. So I want to thank the people that took the time to gather all of these photos, to put it together in such a succinct and powerful way. And the book Over is a centerpiece of the Global Population Speak Out, a worldwide campaign of activists, population and development professionals, and ordinary citizens concerned about the enormous size and rapid growth of the human population and how these issues affect both the future of people and the ability of other species to flourish. Learn more at populationspeakout.org. Thank you very much for listening. Please check out this book. It is important for us to know what we're doing to our planet, because all of the medication in the world won't undo the damage that we create. We must undo the damage. This is Elaine Grohman for Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio. Thank you for listening. Thank you for doing your part to make this world the place it is meant to be, so that all people can enjoy its beauty. Have a great day.